Welcome to Teneo Insights, a podcast that provides in-depth analysis on the issues that matter most to CEOs and their businesses. I'm your host, Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo's political risk advisory business. Let's get started.
Tomorrow marks the four-month anniversary of the start of the war in Ukraine. On February 24th, Vladimir Putin launched his invasion. The world has watched ever since what has ensued. But, you know, beyond the geopolitics, the military strategy, the logistics issues, beyond the international sanctions regimes and international hand-wringing, is something that is a constant across all wars, and that is human suffering. Indeed, in the end, as the British philosopher and social critic Bertrand Russell put it, wars in the end don't tell us who was right. They just tell us who's left. And while place names such as Mariupol and Bucha will forever live in infamy, so will the images of slaughter and, of course, the images of the largest refugee movement in Europe since World War II. Dr. Paul Spiegel is with me today. He is a medical doctor by training. And today he is the director of the Center for Humanitarian Health at Johns Hopkins University. He's internationally recognized for his research on preventing and responding to complex humanitarian emergencies. He has been with the UN Commissioner for High Commissioner for Refugees, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders. And at the outset of this war, he spent more than 6 weeks in Poland and in other Ukrainian border countries as the emergency coordinator for refugee health for the World Health Organization's surge team. Dr. Spiegel joins me today from Nairobi, and he joins thanks to the efforts of our mutual friend and colleague, Dr. Jerry Hauer, who, by the way, remains to this day the guest with the most appearances on this program. So, Paul, Dr. Spiegel, thank you very much for joining today, it's great to have you with us. So, you know, maybe you can start by setting the scene for our audience. You know, give us a sense of what you and your colleagues experienced, you know, at the outset of this war. I think most of us kind of remember it's sort of the typical start of a war, you know, CNN anchors standing on rooftops with their flak jackets and helmets on, seeing the light out there in the distance. But from your perspective on the ground, what was it like?
Great. Well, thank you, Kevin. And thank you also, Jerry Hauer, for making this happen. You know, there's a mixture of the professional and the personal. So I was there about 10 days, I think, after the war started. And we were right on the border, the Polish border. And it was, as I've seen this in many other countries, sadly, but you just saw this wave of humanity coming over. And early on, it was not nearly as organized as it became. We saw a lot of, and we've read about this, but a lot of women and children, and the faces and the almost astonishment makes it extremely difficult to look at. But on the other hand, I gain a lot of hope because I'm there to be able to help, and hopefully the organizations that I work with can make a difference. But it was, I think, despite the warnings, as always in many situations, the quantity of people leaving in such a very short period of time was not expected.
Nevertheless, when we saw the pictures, you know, in those early days, when we saw the pictures on the Ukrainian side, it looked quite chaotic, people trying to get out as fast as possible. But then in many of the pictures on the Polish side, let's say, it looked actually, all things considered, particularly when you say you didn't anticipate the sheer numbers, that it looked relatively well organized. I mean, is it from a professional perspective, was it well organized?
Everything's relative. So, I mean, this crisis is very, very different than most other crises, particularly those the Ukrainians coming into the countries, the European Union countries. So relative to, you know, where I was on the border of Central African Republic, and we're seeing refugees fleeing there, this is incredibly well organized. On the other hand, there at the beginning, you know, you had people from all over Europe coming, saying it was, I've never seen it before, but you'd have cars, you'd have buses coming, saying, we'll take 10 people, we'll take 20 people, we'll go to Italy, we'll go to the Netherlands. But we didn't know who these people are, and the risks of trafficking are what were quite extraordinary at the beginning. And that was eventually addressed. But that vulnerability was still there because people were going all over and it was very unregulated. But conversely, compared to many other countries, very soon, you had already the infrastructure there, very strong infrastructure. Trains were free, buses were free to these people. There were registration centers or reception centers, sorry, that were built very quickly, old malls or schools. And it was extraordinary, the outpouring. And so, for example, you would have, everything was, after the first few days, pretty organic, but you'd have free food, and particularly the World Central Kitchen, I have to give them credit. They were everywhere with Jose Andres and his group. So there was hot food. There was food available. Telecoms were already providing free SIM cards. So it was quite extraordinary. And just I'll end this question by saying it's also the first crisis where, you know, people are coming that I've seen, people are coming over with their dogs and their cats, and they really were, and there were needs. So even in these old malls or these old Tescos that were set up, there were places where you'd have free dog food, things that I've rarely ever seen before in other emergencies.
And when people actually are, when people are fleeing a war and they actually then make it across the border, how did they act? I mean, do you see, is there this palpable sense of relief that they've reached safety, or is there the trauma and horror of leaving loved ones in their homes and whatever else they've left, the belongings and so on that they've left behind? Is it the fear of the unknown? I mean, is there a typical response? And is there a psychological barrier that's crossed as well as the physical border that is crossed?
Hard to say, because I think it is quite different for everyone. But there are, if I can stereotype, there are a lot of issues here. Number one is people perhaps were not expecting the scale of the invasion. So they were not psychologically prepared to leave. Number two, the men are staying there, and they were not allowed to leave, those between 18 and 60. So there's already, as opposed to in other situations where you're leaving with your whole family, you're leaving someone behind, and that's very, very anxiety provoking. And I'll give you an example. At least when I was on the border, we met a woman, a child, and the grandmother, and we started to speak with the woman. We, of course, asked if we could speak with her, and she started to speak normally, meaning she was telling us about her experience and how horrible it was. And then we asked a simple question, because we were there to understand healthcare and what her information was. So we said, do you know that, have you been told yet that you do have access to healthcare here like any national? And she just shut down her face, and it was almost blank. And it was an innocuous question, but somehow that question just maybe was too much for her. And then, you know, she kind of whispered, well, no one told us this. But I think it was more, it's hard to even interpret why that happened. And that probably is not unique to her, which is why mental health support, psychosocial support, is one of the most important issues here, but also one of the most challenging issues to provide, particularly because of language and cultural issues, since they're moving everywhere in Europe.
So I want to step back for just a moment, because, you know, much has been made, obviously, of the fact that not only did Russia start building up its troop presence on the Ukrainian border back in 2021, but on top of that, the U.S. administration and the intel community were telegraphing quite transparently their assumption that this invasion was going to occur, and get ready. And so, you know, the U.S., its allies, you know, at a political level, were getting ready. They were readying the sanctions regimes and so on and so forth. How would you grade, you know, the big organizations like the WHO, ICRC, Doctors Without Borders, all of those that we assume are going to be in place and need to be in place when something like this happens. Did they really take advantage of that long signaling of what was coming so that they were better prepared than, say, when a natural disaster hits?
Yeah, if we clearly divide into Ukraine and then outside of Ukraine. So within Ukraine, the answer is yes, for a couple of reasons. There was already a large presence of these groups, WHO, MSF, the ICRC, already a large group of them there because of Crimea and the issues in the Donbass already. So infrastructure, offices were built and already the logistics and supply chains were there, perhaps not definitely not to the degree that it was needed, but they were easily built up. And again, because of good infrastructure, particularly in Poland, it happened were able to scale up. Europe and the European Union, it's different. And I would say twofold. One is this is a different crisis. So in fact, the roles of the United Nations and the roles of the international NGOs are very different in the EU countries compared to what's happening in Ukraine and a non-EU country like Moldova. So it's the governments are in charge. There are a lot of, as they should be, there are a lot of regulations. And so many of the UN and international NGOs did not have offices in these surrounding countries because there was no need to. And those that did, like WHO, did have offices. They're very small because they were more technical in nature, discussing with the governments non-humanitarian issues, COVID in particular. So that was very different. But the latitude of international NGOs and the UN to respond and is different. And it's not something that I've never really seen before, but it's actually a good thing because, number one, the EU countries have have a great deal of technical expertise and capacity. Number two is money coming to the governments will come mostly from the European Union and or maybe US and others, but it's not in the classic way going to be funneled through the UN agencies that then either provide it to the governments or the international NGOs. So it was challenging for us there to understand what our role can be. It's going to be more in support of the government, but it's also not so easy to work in the European Union because of a lot of the restrictions and regulations in terms of certification. But frankly, we have to think it would be the same way of working in the US. You know, you're not going to have the UN and international NGOs jumping in and running an emergency in that situation. So it's a very different mindset that I think everyone is still getting around.
You know, so for better or for worse, obviously, you have got a lot of experience with these types of emergencies. So what's really been, what's different, about this one? I think you've highlighted some of them, some of the differences, the sort of European resources that could be thrown at this, not only institutionally, but the way that individuals in Europe responded in terms of welcoming. And I'd be interested to know how you would contrast that with, say, the 2015, refugee crisis into Europe, which had which ended up in a fairly ugly manner. But also first mass movement of humanity like this that we've seen also under COVID conditions and how that played in. So talk about the differences that you've seen here versus, others that you've experienced.
Yeah, thank you. It's for the refugee component in the EU countries, it's very, if not completely different than what we're used to. Maybe first, though, you mentioned something that I want to emphasize is I'll start with that almost on February 24th was the invasion. On March 4th, the EU decreed their temporary protection directive for the first time, which allowed Ukrainian refugees to have free access within the EU, have access, they could work, they had, could have the education and they could actually have healthcare the same as nationals, which is, you know, extraordinary. In nearly all situations, refugee situations that I've worked in, that doesn't happen, particularly jobs, right? In most situations, it's, most refugee situations are in low and middle income countries. Their economies may not be as strong as Europe, and certainly their systems are not as strong. So often parallel systems are set up. Here, they opened up basically their countries to the same level as nationals. So that's quite extraordinary. It's also, though, it's laudable, but we can also criticize or say, yes, but what happened previously to non-Europeans? So when you had the Syrians coming over, Africans and Asians, when they were coming over primarily through Turkey to Greece and then Libya to Italy, walls were put up. And, you know, the welcoming was almost the opposite in many ways. And so I think it is important to clearly state that we have Caucasian Christians from Ukraine coming over, and they're very much welcomed. But that's not the case for many other populations. And many of the countries, such as Poland, such as Hungary, have been very welcoming, but, you know, they're still very populist, and they at the same time are putting up borders for nearly everyone else that is not from Europe. And that was hard for, I think, you know, I was working with alongside Syrians that were working for international organizations, and they weren't bitter per se, but it was just almost just astonishment. It's the differences are so overt, and why is that, and how could this be addressed in the future? That's one component. Talking about COVID, I'd like to hit that immediately as well, because Ukraine had one of the lowest COVID vaccination rates. I think it was around 35% for the first vaccine. They're traditionally quite vaccine hesitant. And a lot of vaccine hesitancy has to deal with trusts in government and in systems, and perhaps understandably in the past, given the Ukrainian governments, that they have been mistrustful. But the amount of people coming over so quickly and where they are going to go, it was impossible to test people at the borders. In fact, it was a decision not to test people at the borders for COVID because it would not have been feasible. And number one, and then number two, what are you going to do? So many people coming over, they're moving. The best would be to just give them information, masks, hygiene kits, that sort of thing. So that was a difficult decision from a public health point of view, but a practical and operational decision. That's number one. Number two is that it remains mostly women and children. And so many of us, including myself, were thinking about the experience with Syria, where this massive influx, again, of a middle-income country, Syria at the time, into Jordan and Lebanon. Very quickly, the hospitals were overwhelmed, particularly with cancer patients, with renal dialysis, cardiac patients. This has not been the case at all in the European Union thus far, because, of course, there are people over 60 that are coming, but those numbers are small. I've seen about 8%, and the system can handle that. Really, it's women and children, and they're relatively healthy physically. Mentally is different, and maybe we'll get to that. So the system has thus far been able to handle it. The other, from a health point of view, the other big aspect is that people open their houses all over Europe. And so because you have the Schengen zone, you know, we kept on seeing how many people were coming over, and we would say 3.2 million in Poland at one point, or 3.7, but that doesn't mean they were staying there. They were moving everywhere. And as I said, they had free transportation. So data has and remains difficult because people would cross over. We were able to document that, or the governments documented that, but where they went was complicated. Many did not sign up at the beginning for the temporary protection directive to register in a country because the benefits weren't necessarily there for them immediately, and they were ambivalent because they were all and still remain to hope to go back. But the latest figures I looked before coming on to the show was that There are now, I think, nearly 8 million Ukrainians that have crossed the border. Another, I believe it's 2.7 that have returned, but that can be temporary return, but have gone back. And about out of those 8 million, give or take, 3.7 have actually registered for temporary protection. So at least now we know where they are. But for example, we know the largest number are in Poland, followed by Germany, and then followed by the Czech Republic, Czechia. I'll stop there, but there's a lot more to discuss.
Well, yeah, you know, you made the point earlier that unlike in previous emergencies, you actually saw people crossing the border with their pets as an example. But the other thing that we saw almost everyone cross the border with, particularly the younger people, was of course smartphones. And so I'm wondering about the technological element here. I mean, how does that correlate or correspond then to what you've just been talking about, the challenges, even in a relatively organized system, of being able to track people once they've moved beyond the initial processing zone? But the fact that they've got their phones with them makes them reachable, essentially. Talking about the technology element here.
Sure. Number one is really during the Syrian crisis is where we saw, you know, I was on the Greek shores and we saw these people, you know, we've all seen people coming over in the boats, and they would come over and the first thing they would do would be to find where they kept on their body their cell phone. And most had some sort of smartphone in cellophane. They would take it off, and because they were just from Turkey, very close, they would be calling and they would already be using their cell phones to firstly tell their loved ones back home where they were, but speaking with others. And then particularly WhatsApp was and still is used. And then they would work with each other to understand where the best way to get to Europe and through Europe in from Greece. So the start of that cell phone in terms of humanitarian emergencies, I would say, was really the Syrian crisis, where, you know, UNHCR and others, one of the first things they needed to do was put charging stations wherever they were. This is happening here, but it is complex because the Ukrainian lines, the SIM cards, they changed them and they're using now EU SIM cards, and they're not registered in the same way. So until they do register for temporary protection, we're not able to know where they are. I think you and I discussed this briefly, but there have been some interesting data we received from, which was Facebook, good data, Meta and Facebook, where they were able to track the Ukrainians to know where they were for those that are working on Facebook. And that was helpful because even if we didn't have the exact numbers, we could learn which cities and municipalities had the largest numbers, so we could concentrate there. And then there's another organization in the US actually called Premise, which had been working with the World Health Organization previously. It's using crowdsourcing, and they actually, people sign up and they get a small amount, I think 10 cents for answers. And they were doing this for COVID, to better understand COVID in the Ukraine. And that's been helpful as well for us to better understand, particularly in Ukraine, but as people move out. Those are some examples of technology. Also, very quickly, 1-800 numbers were established, information on health, on host families, and QR codes were everywhere. So while for some there was printed information, QR codes were being used constantly throughout.
So, you know, here we are at the 4-month anniversary of the war, and if anything, it looks like this war is going to drag on for quite some time. And, you know, it may be almost July now, but, you know, when you start thinking about months, you're thinking about winter ultimately setting in, and, you know, all of the hardship that will bring. And, you know, the reports that we're getting about casualties in both militaries on a daily basis is ultimately an unsustainable type of number. These are World War II type numbers of 200 plus soldiers per day being lost. But you know, as we you made the point that, you know, the vast bulk of the refugees coming across the border were women and children because martial law was imposed. Men of fighting age in particular had to stay behind. And so also there was this notion, I think a lot of people had, that this might not last all that long, and therefore they would be able to get home relatively quickly, not necessarily to a status quo ante, to be sure, but nonetheless be back home and rebuild. That may not be the case. And so I wonder here also what you think about this kind of generally welcoming perspective from not just European governments and fiscal authorities, but the European people as well. As this drags on, will that welcome remain as welcoming, number one? And number two, you know, you talk about the benefits and opportunities that are afforded to refugees. Nonetheless, I mean, for perhaps a younger, highly educated, perhaps English or German or whatever speaking part of that population, they might be able to find work and transfer those skills. But for a lot of people coming from Ukraine who maybe only speak Ukrainian or Russian, it's going to be very challenging over the longer haul to transfer whatever work they were doing in Ukraine into a European context, into an EU context. So talk about what you're thinking now about the long haul.
I would say a couple of things. Number one is that I think it's universal that most refugees want to go back when it's peaceful or safe to be able to go back, because besides economic opportunities that may be available elsewhere, we all know there's something about, you know, the land where you've come from, your culture. Here, I think it's even more so because of the martial law, and therefore the men who are fighting are there, and therefore it would be extremely unlikely that many of the Ukrainians would want to stay in different parts of Europe without those men. So I think the pull to go back is very, very strong, and certainly that was what we heard. The other aspect is that people did not expect this war to go on so long, or at least when the generosity all over Europe to host families, and that's another unique aspect, right? I mean, you don't have refugee camps, you don't have massive congregate settings, you have people hosting refugees, mostly women and children. Some are in dormitories, some are in hotels. But no one expected them to, I don't think the hosts expected them to stay with them for months, 6 months. And already, I think there's sort of, okay, they've been with us, we now need to figure out what to do. And those that are in hostels or that are in hotels, it's prime season now and for tourist season, the governments have been very good. The European governments, the EU, have been actually paying people to host. They've been paying hotels, but certainly for the hotels, not that the rates that you would get during tourist season. So there is a big concern. I think all of us have a concern of shelter as number one. What's going to happen if millions of people continue to stay outside of Ukraine as refugees? Where will they be hosted? It's unlikely host families are going to continue in the same level. So what are the options and what can happen? People are talking about building areas, refurbishing certain areas, but that may be tens of thousands of people. We're talking millions. Number one. Number two is, we have consistently seen in all of these emergencies, particularly in some of the middle-income countries, but nearly everywhere, is that after a while, at the beginning, refugees are welcome, but after a while, resentment grows for a variety of reasons. I think number one is there's a big focus on refugees and not perhaps sufficiently on those vulnerable population that are living amongst them. So one of the advice I think that we're all giving very clearly, and the governments are aware of this, is don't concentrate solely on the refugees. I mean, they've made it very clear, the governments, that they are giving the same rights refugees as nationals. They're not giving more rights. But that being said, you've got a lot of international and national NGOs that are providing a lot specifically to the refugees, and they're, of course, in need. But with inflation, with the increase in the food prices, it's going to be, I would think there will be eventually be, I hope there will not be, but I think it would be likely that there will be a backlash, as we've seen in many other countries, regardless of if they are, you know, from the same, let's say, ethnic group. I think this is going to become more and more difficult, particularly because of the rest of the global issues right now, as we're talking about inflation and that's hitting everyone in the wallet.
Yeah. It's interesting. You can see even in the sort of the, you know, the quality broadsheets, the New York Times and the papers in London, you know, the real estate that is afforded to the war on the front page is diminishing. But the real estate about the impact of the war on the domestic populations in the U.S. and Europe is increasing. You know, I want to shift here a little bit. You know, a few days ago, the 2021 Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Dmitry Muratov, the Russian journalist, auctioned off his Nobel Prize to support UNICEF in aiding Ukrainian children and families. And it fetched a mind-blowing $103.5 million from an anonymous bidder who clearly wanted to make a point along with making a big financial donation to UNICEF. And I bring this up because, you know, a lot of attention has been paid to Western companies. Western companies, you know, especially the news was around their pullout from the Russian market, as an example. But, you know, if you look back early on, American companies and their employees, you know, really wanted to step up, I think, in a lot of ways. They rallied to the cause. They gave money. They matched employee donations. When appropriate, they helped out logistically. I think a lot of firms, Teneo included, when we had employees, colleagues who had family members stuck in Ukraine, did what we could to help that process along. And we were proud to do it and gratified that we were able to help. But I wonder, given your experiences, and as we head into these longer phases, and again, when the war starts to fade from the front pages of the paper, you know, what else companies can do? Companies individually, companies collectively in concert with each other, in partnership with governments and with NGOs. You know, I think that there are companies would like to help. Their employees would like to help. But there's always this question of, well, what do we do? And what would actually be helpful?
Yeah. No, thanks for asking. I think, again, divide clearly between Ukraine and then the refugees. We were getting so many requests for doctors, for nurses, for just people to come and volunteer. We don't need that. We need that from the Europeans who are already doing it. But it's more gratifying for, let's say, the person that is coming as a physician or someone coming to hand out goods, let's say, to people in Poland or in Czech Republic. But that's more gratifying probably for the person than it is for the actual response. There is a need clearly for money, and there's going to be continue to be. But I'll get to that in one second. There's also the issue of long-term, short-term and long-term. And so let me first get to the short-term. Within the EU, the problem that we saw, and it's very different from other situations, is that you have municipalities, and we call them community-based organizations, DBOs, meaning it's a small group here and they have a psychologist coming to help, and then they're collecting goods and they're in a small area or in another. So you have lots of different small groups supporting. Other than the Red Cross, it's not as if like you have the IRC or the MSFs opening up clinics everywhere or opening up big shelters. So the issue is that, you know, I won't make that many friends probably by saying this, but of course it's good to give to these international NGOs, but the money needs to get to these local municipalities. And when I was there, and I've checked still, the money coming, let's say, to the central government isn't always getting to these municipalities. So one way would be that we need to figure out is a way to get money to these local small mom and pop sort of shops, that they need to be verified and they need to get to the municipalities. We don't have a very good way of doing that right now. It's more individual. So I don't know what. So one way almost immediately would be to say, for those organizations that are, you know, are working, businesses and others that are working in these countries, particularly in the big ones, Warsaw, Krakow, Prague, others, are there ways that we could figure out to funnel money to them? Because that's where the need is. Already, besides mental health and burnout amongst the refugees, mental health and burnout of these volunteers, it already was there. I mean, you have local doctors, you have psychologists that are just volunteering their time, and they are not used to seeing this sort of misery and extreme amongst the people that they're dealing with. And they can't continue to volunteer, so they need to get paid. That's in the short term for the refugees. Another challenge, though, I would like everyone to think about is some of the bigger issues. Some of them are technological. So we are still not yet getting sufficient information amongst the health systems of what is happening. And there's a variety of reasons there. Number one is that the governments may not wish to share it. But number two is the systems are such that not everything is electronic. One of the areas that we need to really work in and try to crack is health information passports or health travel passports, whatever you wish to call it, so that we have people with TB, with HIV, on cancer drugs. They come, they flee all over the world, and we don't know the protocol that they're getting. We don't know the stage. We don't know the results. We know it can be done through blockchain. We have big issues in terms of protection and data security. But the efficiency of having such health travel passports where, you know, we have to be very careful. HIV, people can be very discriminated against. But that would be huge. It's a big, big problem for us. Another way is another aspect where it could be a tremendous help is translation. For example, you've got a lot of, right now we didn't get into this, but the way the healthcare system is functioning there, for the most part, you have family doctors and general practitioners that are supposed to see the people, and then they are the gatekeepers to the system. Whether it be at that level, translation, Ukrainian and Russian is needed. Their Google Translate is insufficient for this sort of way. So yeah. There has been talks, you know, there are, for example, Hopkins Hospital pays translators from all over to be able to do this so someone can call. I'm sure there's a way that we could use the Ukrainian diaspora and the Russian diaspora, those that speak Russian, and I'm aware of the sensitivities. But for the most part, we found the Ukrainians would be willing to speak Russian without a problem as long as they could get across. So is there a way that we could improve these translations so that we can provide the care much more efficiently and culturally appropriate? Those are two aspects, but there are many, many more issues in terms of logistics, supply chains that companies can support to getting what is needed where, this sort of so-called last mile. We've done a lot, but there's more. And then finally, I think there is the Facebooks, the cell phone companies. There always remains, and in Europe, the data protection is very stringent, but there needs to be a way that we can get data to be able to better inform how we're responding. And it's still insufficient at this point.
Okay, interesting. I want to turn now to maybe what's coming next.
One other thought, because this has come up, is support. There needs to be better ways to hear, and this is rather unique, but for the shelter, what are we going to do now as what are shelter solutions as people that are, you know, the host families are no longer able or willing to continue? I had some interesting talks with some folks in London recently, and they were thinking about ways that we could either build types of houses that could benefit both the refugees and the national population, the more vulnerable populations, in the longer term, dealing with insurance companies that, you know, if they were government backed, and we often talk about something called the humanitarian development nexus, which is the idea that you want to provide humanitarian support immediately, but if you can think carefully about how that support is provided, can you in the long term improve the situation for that, for the nationals? And public housing, we know, is always a major issue, particularly in places like London and others. So could there be a way, and you know, the companies that are listening, as a challenge to be able to figure that out, both financially as well as logistically?
Got it. I want to turn to what's coming next, because as is so often the case with a with an emergency, it is a part of a ongoing set of events, and they compound upon each other. And as we know, Russia and Ukraine are the breadbasket of Europe, one of the great breadbaskets of the world, producing an incredible percentage of the world's grain, cereals, vegetable oils, and the like. Those supplies are obviously now constrained, and future harvests are as well. On top of the climate change issue, and we're already seeing other major producers from China to Brazil to India being impacted due to climate issues. And then, of course, on top of that, all of the logistics and shipping issues related to and still unfolding from the pandemic. So food crisis, also leading to humanitarian disaster, number one, but also refugee flows and political instability. What are you and your organization, you know, anticipating on that front now?
Yeah, this is like so many other. There are a lot of unanticipated consequences. And so, I mean, you mentioned many, but the other big issue is fertilizer that is coming really from Russia. And on top of that, the inflation and making everything much more complicated. So we're in a situation that is really, really serious. And I'm here in Nairobi, not specifically for this, but we were meeting with the World Health Organization to discuss some of these issues. And WHO has already raise the level of alert for what's happening in East Africa and other countries, because of we're already seeing in Somalia and parts of the Horn of Africa incredibly high increases in malnutrition and potentially famine or famine-like conditions. So it is extraordinary what's happening, and I think people are not particularly hopeful at this point. For a variety of reasons, this is going to require a lot of action right now and a lot of money to be able to address this immediately. And the donor all over right now, when you look at Afghanistan, for example, before I was in Ukraine, I was in Afghanistan in November and December. It's already the amount, the appeal that has been asked for Afghanistan, and the amount of money is very, very little. So we're in a very, very bad situation right now, in my view, because Putin is obviously using this as a lever to reduce sanctions. And given all the others, what's happening now, I think we're going to sadly see a great deal more of death due to food security, and particularly some of these countries, both in the Middle East and in Africa, due to this crisis. And while we deal with the political situation, there needs to be a huge influx of funding right now for food and fertilizer and seeds here. So it's really, really serious. And I'm if history is any lesson right now, we will not react in the same way, given what's happening in Ukraine and given the again, it's often the realpolitik and geopolitical significance. The focus will be on Ukraine and the refugees, and perhaps less here in the spotlight of where I am now in East Africa.
Yeah. And so, I mean, obviously political instability is a result of a complex set of factors, but clearly, when we look at specific events like the Arab Spring, when you look back to a food seller who lit himself on fire in Tunisia, there are these catalytic moments that are related to food prices. Not just what is happening to global prices because of what's happening in Ukraine and Russia, but Ukraine and Russia themselves, particularly important to the supply in places like Egypt and Lebanon and others. So I'm wondering, where are you most worried? As you see this kind of playing out and you look where the stresses are and you look at where the institutional and political strength is and where the societies are most vulnerable, you know, are there countries or areas that are, you know, of most concern to you?
I mean, as a, you know, as a public health doctor, I try to look, certainly for us, it's really more the data and where the most food insecurity and then ultimately the acute malnutrition and mortality rates. So there, it's going to be clearly right now, it's here in Somalia. There's some big issues in Mozambique because there's also, sorry, we didn't mention also in many of these areas, this is all happening on top of a drought, serious drought. So that's, it's just, there are too many factors right now occurring at the right time to make this, I hate the word perfect storm, to make this an extreme event. So I, you know, particularly worried here and in Somalia. Lebanon had already been going through a crisis, as we know, and it's the instability, and there's a great deal of instability in Lebanon pre this, and then this is going to exacerbate. From a political point of view, though, sometimes some things are unpredictable. But when you look already what's been happening, unrelated to maybe the food crisis in Ukraine, but what's happening in Sri Lanka now, and what's occurring just because of the responses of people to increase in food prices and the pressure from many of these governments to reduce subsidies on petrol. I think this is going to be it's going to be a situation that's quite hard to predict, as was the Arab Spring. So I don't have a brilliant prognostication other than that we're extremely worried and we're trying to look at least where the most death will occur.
So, you know, you're in Africa at the moment. So I want to ask you about, I mean, obviously, a lot of the things you're talking about, there are variables which are unpredictable. But one thing where we have some clarity of direction is on demographics. And, you know, the world, for the most part, globally, birth levels are slightly below replacement if you X out Sub-Saharan Africa. Sub-Saharan Africa is at 80 to 90% above replacement. So, as we look at the political instability of the region, which probably is going to get worse as the great powers vie for green metals and new and things of that nature, the ravages of climate change and environmental degradation, the growth of these mega cities in places like Nigeria and the like. What is the community? What is the profession, really girding for in Africa over the course of the rest of this century?
Yeah. As an example, I'm here working on specifically on a maternal mortality project in conflict settings. So we have colleagues from Nigeria, Somalia, DRC, and I'm having a blank, but it'll come to me. Oh, in South Sudan. So we're dealing specifically, and everyone is very pessimistic. I think one thing that you're getting at is going to continue to be a major problem everywhere, but will be exacerbated now, will be migration. And there are insufficient policies in terms of how migration should work globally. In Africa, one of the biggest within Africa itself, South Africa has been one of the biggest magnets for migration. But there's been significant increase in xenophobia and the same populism that has occurred in much of the West is occurring elsewhere. So I think we're going to see, and combined with climate change over the next little bit, we're going to see a lot of unpredictable migration with countries and policies that are ineffectual, let's say. And I'm concerned that the West or the wealthier countries, not just the West, but South Africa and others may put up more walls because of the amount of migration that is occurring. From my own human rights refugee, I'm also very concerned that asylum law will continue to be degraded, meaning that there's one p- people moving for economic migration, but then there are also people moving for fear of their lives and security and safety. That will, like what happened with COVID, already that started to be degraded. So it's a it's very concerning. And then so within Africa and within the Middle East, but I also, from a geopolitical point of view, Turkey is becoming, you know, hugely important, and we're already seeing what's happening with Finland and Sweden in joining NATO. European Union paid them $6 billion a while back so that they would, you know, keep refugees there and not allow them to come over. And that's quite blunt, but that is the case. So Turkey's going to be in a very strong geostrategic situation because they can turn on and off the tap as they wish. And I think we'll see the same in Libya.
You talk about sort of irrespective of policies and, you know, sort of bureaucratic walls being put up and money and so on and so forth. But there is this human imperative. There's this human imperative to protect your family from, you know, famine or war or, you know, whatever. And so people will go on the move. And, you know, we see that at the southern border. It's an issue here in the United States, of course. But when you're talking about Africa, I mean, you're talking about the numbers that that I think we ought to be contemplating there, right? The number one sort of, you know, target in a way has got to be Europe, I imagine, because of its proximity and its wealth and so on and so forth. So is the European Union and Commission and the member states, are they really preparing for what this, you know, real flow is going to look like and how they're going to deal with it politically and from a humanitarian perspective and so on, because it's coming.
Yeah, it's coming. I would say, I mean, to nuance it a bit, I think there's always internal movement. So you'll have your internal movement from perhaps the rural areas to the cities, which is constantly happening. And then within Africa, you'll have movements towards the wealthier countries, the Nairobis, the Cote d'Ivoire, the South Africa. And then, yes, you will have movements more towards likely Europe. I think everyone is aware of it, but meaning the EU, but I would, you know, pose the same question in terms of the US and migration policy in the US. We're all aware of the issues, but is there the political will, I guess, number one, to be able to address that? I don't think that's the case in the United States, and that certainly will not be the case in Europe, which is already quite divided before. And then, so there's the political component, and then there will have to be a lot of compromise because there isn't a single policy, right, that's going to say this will take care of it. I mean, hoping and helping that development, we improve the outcomes or the livelihoods in these countries takes a long time and often fails. We don't do particularly well in development always, but that takes decades, if not a generation. So we will need to think about much of the short term and then the longer term of how do we try to address these flows. I think that's going to be extremely difficult, as I said, politically, but on top of that, with climate change and the unpredictability of that, because we won't just see movements, we'll also see at this point perhaps unpredictable, but some may be predictable, issues of conflict over water with climate change, certainly in the Middle East and in other areas as well. I'm not being very optimistic, am I, today?
Well, you know, it leads me, we only have a few minutes left, so it leads me to my last question, which is kind of the why do you do it, right? I mean, you're a physician by training. But this is where you've dedicated your professional life. And I imagine that all of the sort of the trauma and heartbreak that you see out there is then matched by the gratification of the successes and the people saved and the families reunited. But at the same time, there is the knowledge that is never going to end. It is always going to be sort of an unsatisfying work in progress to a degree. So what led you to this? I know you're painted sort of a pessimistic picture of the world, but how about the picture of your profession and your field?
I think most people I know fall into this sort of, they don't plan. I was a bit of a strange bird in terms of when I was 16, I read about Doctors Without Borders in Time magazine. It was just really the beginning, oldish now. So I read about it and I said, this is what I want to do. And when I was young, it was a mixture of, you know, excitement, adrenaline, seeing the world, and of course, helping. But there was, it's really exciting when you're, you know, medical school, just finishing medical school or residency and doing this, and you feel like you're doing something real and you're in the middle of something. And so I think that's it for a lot of people. As you get older and you perhaps get more senior, it's also quite exciting and gratifying that what you do could have effect on a positive effect, I hope, on many people's lives. So I think that's what keeps me going at this point. But I must say, every emergency affects one in a different way. And it does take a little bit out of you each time. And this time I've had some intense experiences with the Taliban in November, December, and now here. So it is fatiguing at times. But I think some of us, there are some people I meet who are just completely cynical, and you almost want to say, okay, now it's time to do something else. For others, I don't think that's the case. Yeah, for at least for me, that's not the case. It's still, I find it exciting. And because I've done so many now, I also like to use my past experience and learn from this current experience. I mean, what I saw in the European Union, in what we've learned, for example, is that in the future, we hope that more and more governments are more competent and capacitated to be able to address refugee issues, so that we need to learn from what happened in the European Union, that where that competence exists, we need to rethink a bit about how the international system should respond, because in many ways, it still is not ready. It means it's going to mean less power. It's going to be a little bit less hands-on, likely less money. That's something, for example, that I'm quite interested in exploring further. How will the international system adapt to improve capacities in the long term? So there's still a lot we all have to do, and I look forward to continuing doing it.
Well, I think I speak on behalf of our audience by saying we appreciate very much that you and your colleagues are out there on the front line. And I want to a lot also for pointing out that there is still more that corporate America can be doing if it wants to on not only the Ukraine and Ukrainian diaspora front, but on all of these ongoing crises and emergencies and those yet to come. So, Dr. Paul Spiegel, thank you so much for joining us today. I wish you safe travels back from Kenya, and we hope to speak to you soon.
So there you have it. I'm Kevin Kachawara. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Teneo Insights. If you have any questions about any of the topics we cover, please reach out to us at teneoinsights@teneo.com. See you next time.